childlike, manipulative, either cold or smothering as mothers, and driven to excess by their hormones. We assumed that men were mentally healthy. We were not taught to pathologize or criminalize male drug addicts or alcoholics, men who physically battered, raped, or even murdered women or other men. We did not have diagnostic categories for male sexual predators or pedophiles. The psychiatric literature actually blamed the mothers, not the fathers of such men, for having sent them over the edge. But mainly, we were trained to understand and forgive such super manly men. Boys will be boys. In other words, our so-called professional training merely repeated and falsely professionalized our previous cultural education. I knew that what I was being taught was neither useful nor true. At this point, I'd been attending feminist meetings almost nonstop for 2 years, surrounded by other women who were equally passionate, confident, vocal, and educated. In the spirit of that time, I became, and have remained, a liberation psychologist and a legal activist. I was a multidisciplinary researcher who loved both myths and footnotes. I refused to write in an obfuscated Mandarin language. I was psychoanalytically and spiritually oriented, but I was also steadfastly political. In 1969, I co-founded the Association for Women in Psychology, AWP. In those days, women founded new organizations every month, sometimes every day. Emboldened by feminism, we created our own organizations where we and our ideas would be welcome, and in which we could teach ourselves and each other what we needed to know. We hadn't learned it elsewhere. For example, I had a brand new PhD, had completed a hospital internship, and was still enrolled in a psychoanalytic training institute. But I knew almost nothing about how to help another woman, or a man, understand her own life. No matter, I was secretly studying what women really wanted from psychotherapy. I planned to present my findings at the annual convention of the American Psychological Association, APA, in 1970. I went to the convention, but I did not deliver this paper. Instead, on behalf of AWP, I asked APA members for $1 million in reparations on behalf of women who had never been helped by the mental health professions, but who had, in fact, been further abused, punitively labeled, overly tranquilized, sexually seduced while in treatment, hospitalized against their wills, given shock therapy, lobotomized, and above all, unnecessarily described as too aggressive, promiscuous, depressed, ugly, old, angry, fat, or incurable. Maybe AWP could set up an alternative to a mental hospital with the money, I said, or a shelter for runaway wives. The audience of more than 2,000, mostly male members, laughed at me, loudly, nervously. Some looked embarrassed, others relieved. Obviously, I was crazy. Afterwards, colleagues told me that jokes had been made about my penis envy. I started writing Women and Madness on the plane back to New York. I immersed myself in the psychoanalytic literature, located biographies and autobiographies of women who'd been psychiatrically treated or hospitalized, women who refused to eat or who refused to marry, women who were unable to leave home or to lead lives outside the family. I read novels and poems about sad, mad, bad women, and devoured mythology and anthropology, especially about goddesses, matriarchies, and Amazon warrior women. It is no accident that I wrote about goddesses in Women and Madness, great earth mothers like Demeter, who rescued her daughter Persephone from kidnapping, rape, and incest, Amazon figures like Diana, who protected women in childbirth and who literally ran with the wild beasts. Such goddess images are our collective human role models. We repress them at our own peril. Both women and men are strengthened by examples of women who embody all the human, not merely the feminine or biologically maternal, possibilities. It is also no accident that I did not fully examine the dark side of Demeter and